ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital. I'm Saeed Pourreza with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of the region. Israel continues its wholesale slaughter of Palestinians, constantly bombing areas near Gaza's overcrowded Al-Shifa hospital, with all hospitals in the territory stretched beyond capacity. It's also intensifying raids in the West Bank, killing hundreds of people there. The fighting on the ground in Gaza has also intensified as the Palestinian resistance confronts Israeli occupation forces as they push deeper into Gaza City. Dozens of Palestinians have been killed in intense overnight Israeli bombardments in the Jabalia refugee camp in the north and Sabra in western Gaza. Thousands of Palestinians are having to walk long distances to flee the Israeli bombardment in the north. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has again rejected the prospect of a ceasefire without the release of captives. CIA Director William Burns is in the region to negotiate the release of those captives. No talk, of course, of releasing the thousands of Palestinians held hostage by the Israeli regime. In Europe, France is hosting a humanitarian aid conference in Paris. Will it increase international participation in providing humanitarian aid to Gazans? In the UK, a mass demonstration is planned for this weekend, despite attempts by the British government to cancel it. At least 10,569 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks on Gaza since October 7th, with the number mounting by the hour. A lot to unpack there, and joining me to do just that. Here in the studio, broadcaster and producer Sakina Datu, and via Skype, Palestinian activist Khalid El-Jamal. Khalid is a British-Palestinian refugee born in South Lebanon, currently a postgraduate student studying diplomacy. Welcome to you both. Let me start with you, Sakina. More terrible news, as you heard there, overnight as the death toll is mounting. Let's start this off by getting your reflections on what's been happening there.
So I think, I mean, all of us have been witnessing this for days on end now. And I think what we need to understand is that what this tells us is that all lives don't really matter, that this is colonialism. And in colonialism, all human beings are not the same. So people who are controlling you, they see you as subhuman. And what's happening in Palestine is most definitely those people are being treated as subhuman. What's really surprising, and I think it should not be surprising by now, but still, I think for those of us who still hold on to the values that we consider to be humanitarian, to be watching war crimes, to be watching ethnic cleansing on our screens, literally live, day and night, it's a dire situation, but again, not so surprising if you consider the fact that if you look at the history of colonialism, this is how it has always been. If they were ever to consider people in Palestine to be anywhat equal human beings, this wouldn't be happening.
And Khalid, same question to you. All humans are equal. Some humans are more equal.
100%. Going off what she just said, I think that she's spot on. I think that the current genocide in Palestine has actually shown that not all lives matter. The amount of sheer violence that has taken place in Palestine and the brutality in the images that are actually coming out onto our screens, onto our social media, it hasn't really shaken our governments yet. I mean, you can't even get our opposition, our left wing, to call for a ceasefire. So, no, it's not really, not all lives do matter, and Palestinian lives definitely don't matter.
And Sakina, I want to pick up what Khalid just referenced, and that is none of what we have seen on our television screens, on social media, has shaken our politicians to call for a ceasefire. What is that rooted in? Why is it they're dragging their feet to stop the slaughter from going on?
I think, again, we'll have to look into the history to see this. I mean, you know, much as we want to sometimes sugarcoat the countries of the West. The reality is that the background of these countries is in white supremacists. And that exists every day. In the US, for example, we see the plight of black lives, and that is still going on. Again, in the UK, we are a little more, it's not so obvious sometimes, and looks like everybody is treated the same. But there is a concept of white supremacy. Britain, of course, were the colonizers of the entire world. And so I think among the ruling elite, that mentality is very much alive as yet. And the change will not come because this is something that is strategic. It's not just based on human emotions. Britain created Israel, so this is their baby, and they don't care. They will not look anywhere else because this is what they have created. And they will support it come what may, because also you have to understand that there is Palestine was put there for a reason. It's a strategic place, and Britain needs that. U.S. needs that. So, you know, a few people dying here, there, humanitarian crisis, as long as it's serving their purpose, their economic, their political needs to be in that area, it's all the mentality of supremacy of every kind. And therefore, in this instance, human lives really are not such a big issue.
Mm-hmm. And Khaled, you know, we heard Sakina describe what is happening there as a white supremacist thing going on, colonization, and all the rest of it. You, as someone who has experienced being a refugee, what is life like for a Palestinian born or living under the thumb of the an oppressor or a colonizer?
Yes, so I think that one thing we have to get right is Israel was established and was based on a settler colonialism project. That was the entire scope of Zionism of Theodor Herzl. And I think that the ethnic cleansing, the displacement, forcible displacement, this is nothing new to Israel. This is something that has been going on since 1948, when my grandparents were forcibly removed from their home in Akka to southern Lebanon. I'm a third generation refugee, and apparently I can't even ask to go back to my homeland when you have white Europeans with absolutely no heritage, with no connection to the land of Palestine or the Middle East. They are able to take on free birthright trips to go and visit. And, you know, they've got the opportunity to own land, to get citizenship. So it really is all based on white supremacy. And, you know, Middle Easterners being seen as these types of savages not being able to rule. It's all rooted in colonialism, which this very country that we live in implemented. So I think that what she's saying is very right. And, you know, the consistent dehumanization of Palestinians, and it's still happening up until today. And as long as the Western states continue to support Israel, I don't think that we will see any change.
Sakina, we heard from the American officials what the post-bombardment Gaza will look like. What do you think is going to look like?
So obviously for them, they are hoping that they are going to be able to displace as many Palestinians as possible, and then Israel to have a control over Gaza. I think they are short-sighted in that they think that the fear of attacks would be abated. The fact that they think they can live in this region in peace, I think that is the biggest mistake that they ever make. Mm-hmm. They are never going to be able to live there in peace, because you can kill as many of the Palestinians as you want, but there will always be resistance. The resistance cannot be wiped out, mm-hmm. because this is an occupation, this is colonialism, and we have seen it time and again happen into the world. And one day that occupation ends, and one day that colonialism ends. So whatever their plans are post the war in Gaza, if they are hoping that there's going to be no Hamas, if they are hoping that they are going to be able to live in peace, having taken the illegal settlements and enjoy that area, it's not going to happen.
And the colonizers have never left on their own volition. They had to be forced out.
Absolutely.
Sakina, let's continue with you. This talk of Palestinians running Gaza, we hear, for example, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, calling what's happening a genocide, just like much of the rest of the world's. But what he's not doing is revoking the Genocide Convention of the United Nations. Why is he not doing that? Is it because he's waiting for the situation to get to a position where the Palestinians will accept him?
I think Mahmoud Abbas does not have any power, doesn't have any authority. And again, you know, it's not the first time that it's come across that he is a stooge, you know, of the Americans who's been put in place there. And yes, it took tons of people to die before he even made his first appearance to even say anything, to be there for his people. So this is what they want. Post-war also, they want to have people like Mahmoud Abbas in place who will not oppose them, you know, who will wait for the calling from the U.S. and then take action. Mm. So that's not going to happen. But in terms of the question before you were asking about, you know, Israel and the U.S. not seeing eye to eye, you know, I think Israel is like an entitled child of the U.S. Mm-hmm. So they know, you know, Netanyahu knows that whatever he says, if he throws a tantrum, America's not going to be able to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. So they're like a poodle for them, you know. I mean, even if they don't want, even if they tell something to Israel and they don't listen, there is nothing that is going to happen. So it's really, I think for the British and Americans, they have created this child who is now so entitled, we'll not even listen to them.
Very good point there. Again, we're going to pause the discussion briefly because the Israeli bombardment of Gaza has international significance, and wading in was China, with their foreign ministry spokesman reiterating the country's position.
China supports the unity and solidarity of the Arab Muslim countries in stepping up their mediation efforts to promote a ceasefire and the resumption of peace talks. China supports responsible actions by the Security Council to protect civilians and alleviate the humanitarian situation in Gaza. We call for an international peace conference with greater authority as soon as possible to build a new consensus on the restoration and realization of the two-state solution.
Life coach and media personality Fahima Mohammed is with us for the first installment of Palestine in the Media. And Fahima, what is on today's menu?
We have our first story here, Emily Callahan. And her story is quite extraordinary, as some may say, because it's actually being taken seriously because it's coming from her, and some comments mention it's because it's coming from a European or white nurse, whereas when people are reporting of all the atrocities and catastrophes, it's not necessarily being believed. So we'll hear what she has to say first.
Would you go back to Gaza?
In a heartbeat. In an absolute heartbeat. My heart is in Gaza. It will stay in Gaza. The Palestinian people that I worked with, both our national staff in the office as well as my staff at Indonesia Hospital, were some of the most incredible people I've ever met in my life. When everything went off and we got the notice to move south of Wadi Gaza, I was texting my nurses at Indonesia Hospital, and I said, we lost a nurse weekend one. He was killed when the ambulance outside the hospital was blown up. And I was texting them when we got the evacuation orders, and I said, did any of you move south? Did any of you get out? Like, are any of you coming down this way? And the only answer I got was, this is our community, this is our family, these are our friends.
No, she didn't get the do you condemn Hamas question.
No, absolutely not. It's a different interview, and obviously when Palestinians are invited or pro-Palestinians, they are obviously greeted and, you know, treated very differently and also questioned about the evidence of what they put forward.
And not a shred of cynicism in her words, really.
Absolutely. So it was a rare interview. This is from Congresswoman
Rashida
Tlaib. Yes, and she is also American Palestinian, serving in Congress.
The only one.
Yes, she is, and she gives a very powerful, emotional speech, and we'll hear some of that now. Actually,
only Palestinian American serving in Congress, Mr. Chair, and my perspective is needed here now more than ever. I will not be silenced, and I will not let you distort my words. Folks forget I'm from the city of Detroit, the most beautiful, blackest city in the country, where I learned to speak truth to power even if my voice shakes. Trying to bully or censor me won't work, because this movement for a ceasefire is much bigger than one person. It's growing every single day. They are done watching our government, Mr. Chair, supporting cutting off...
So she was censured by other congresspeople,
yes.
But she is receiving solidarity and support across the pond here from fellow politicians.
Absolutely. I mean, as she speaks, her voice was trembling and she was very, very emotional. And at the end of the day, she did say that even if you try to, you know, censor her, there's 71% of Michigan Democrats who support the ceasefire. So mm-hmm. you cannot censor that. And there was a lot more that she did say as well.
There sure was. So as the atrocities go on, no call for a ceasefire, but Israel is tightening the stranglehold on Gaza. For all its drawbacks, the rise of social media has provided a way for Palestinians to share their daily lived experiences and is exposing the weakness in the deeply skewed narratives that have dominated public discourse. Latifa Abu Chakra is back with us to share with us how that is having an impact, Latifa.
Well, people are actually starting to question why the American people, the Bible Belt of America specifically, you know, the ones with so much power and influence, why they are so supportive of Israel. Is it a monotheistic, you know, brotherhood? Is that what it is?
The idea is that once Jews return to Israel, Jesus Christ will come back to earth and rapture Christians up to heaven. And in some interpretations, this will actually lead to the death of two-thirds of all Jews. Doesn't quite sound like the holiest alliance, does it? Still, the state of Israel is more than happy to accept evangelical Christian support. Listen to what Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told attendees of this evangelical conference.
Now there are millions and millions of devout Christians who stand with Israel. So I want to thank you on behalf of all the people of Israel.
So what do Palestinian Christians think of all this?
You have my sisters and brothers who are supposed to be my support, actually doing all their best to support the ones who are oppressing us. It makes me angry.
That's Munzer Ishaq, a Palestinian pastor who lives in Bethlehem, the city believed to be the birthplace of Jesus. By the way, Bethlehem is now surrounded by this massive Israeli wall and military checkpoints.
Why is their read of the Bible so different?
Evangelicals read the Bible in a very literal and simple way. They see in it an image of God who is a tribal God who favors one nation over everyone else based on a promise that's thousands of years old.
Considering Christianity preaches equality and loving thy neighbor, I wondered, how does someone like Sharon justify her support of Israel? The idea is that once Jews...
So the Christian evangelical support for Israel is very well established. It's commonplace.
It's suggesting very clearly that it's an anti-Semitic stance. You know, they want the Jews out of their own vicinity, back into, you know, Palestine, because that will facilitate the return of Jesus, which apparently, according to their prophecies, will kill two-thirds of Jews. It's really, it's a really sick alliance, and it's something that Israel doesn't care about, because Israel doesn't care about Christians. They will happily accept public opinion, and they've said so many occasions that the American people are stupid and that they will capitalize on their stupidity, and they will just throw words around like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Nazi and 9/11, and they'll just play on the emotions of the Americans to rally their support to take their money, which is what's been happening. Mm-hmm. But this change in narrative, where Americans are starting to see the truth because of citizen journalism, and they're starting to ask questions about where their tax money is being spent.
Given these bombings are being done using our tax dollars, perhaps we should ask some questions. For example, how does bombing a densely populated land strip filled 50% with children constitute self-defense? How does bombing hospitals, churches, mosques, and UN schools constitute self-defense? Well, you say, if Hamas fighters are hiding in the hospital using the civilians as human shields, okay, let's say they are. Are you arguing that flattening the hospital and killing newborns in their incubators and their moms in the NICU, cancer patients, someone with a broken leg, the doctors, nurses, and just the women and kids hiding in the hospital, that that's not a war crime? Because you would be wrong, according to international law. If you were a teenager living in an open-air prison, getting bombed day and night by, let's say, Mexico, and Mexican police kicked in the door and raided your house anytime they wanted and turned off the water and cut off your food, what are you going to do? Side with them? Help them while you're dying? That's like asking why black folks don't help or trust the police. And given these bombings are
part of the so-called turn in the tide is attributed to the emergence of these young, knowledgeable, articulate Palestinian men and women who have been resisting, documenting everything and sharing it with the rest of the world.
Absolutely.
Latifa Abu Chakra, thank you. All right, let's continue the conversation with my guest in the studio and on Skype. I'll start with Khalid. And I want to ask you about your reaction to any of the stories that you heard before this segment, perhaps on the Rashida Tlaib, the Palestinian congresswoman's comments inside the U.S. Congress, as well as the censuring by her fellow congresswomen and men.
I think it was pretty sad to watch, and the amount of dehumanization that she received in the United States when she was calling for very, very basic things. They've accused her of anti-Semitism when all she was calling for was a ceasefire. I mean, it was pretty sad to see. And it's not just in the United States. We're seeing it here with them labeling our protests as hate marches and dehumanizing basically all Muslims. We're seeing it in our schools as well, where many students are being referred to prevent for wearing the Palestinian flag or discussing a ceasefire in schools. And this rhetoric really has to stop, and this censorship just goes to show, are we really living in free societies where we can speak about whatever we want? Because in the United States and in the UK, we can call our leaders any word in the book, but the minute you touch Israel, it becomes a huge issue. So it's being highlighted now more than ever, and I think it's being exposed openly, and our governments are just not even reacting to it because they know that everyone knows that you cannot criticize Israel.
Mm-hmm. Government reaction, and Sakina, I want to continue that with you. We've seen signs of dissent here with the Labour frontbencher Imran Hussein resigning to advocate for a Gaza ceasefire. Is there now a reckoning from UK politicians that their constituents are not happy about their inhumane behavior? Mm-hmm.
I think that is happening, for sure that is happening, and not only at that level, not only at the government level, but we're just talking about, for example, the nurse in the U.S., Rashida, you know. These are things that we didn't see happening before. Mm. So even though this is not the first time that Gaza has been plunged into the kind of despair that it has happened, but we are seeing people in places that were not there before, who are speaking out. Like I said before, you know, I think it is very easy to get into a gloom and doom and say, you know, everything is negative, but it isn't. Mm-hmm. And I think we are seeing the same in Britain, and we are seeing that the people on the grassroots, those who genuinely are, you know, not part of the government, of the ruling elite, these people are actually taking a stock and are re-questioning their alliances. Because it's one thing, you know, to have listened to BBC, for example, years after years, and to believe that these are tests, it's all negative. No, of course they are challenges. They are huge challenges. And these are the challenges that we have to rise up to. When I think there is fear factor, people are being clamped down, speeches being clamped down, no doubt about that. But I think we need to take inspiration from Gaza. If those people are not scared to lay down their lives and will thank God for doing that, I mean, what reason do we have to fear for the loss of income, for the fear of loss of, you know, connections? We're not facing what they are facing over there. Yeah. And so if we are in any way to talk about solidarity with Palestinians, it's for us now to stand up and to say, you know, we won't be silenced.
And there is a wealth of information out there. And they say, you know, in the age of information, not wanting to know is a choice. Yeah. Ignorance is a choice. Khalid, the same question to you that I asked Sakina earlier.
Yeah, so I think, what was the question?
That we have seen here signs of dissent with the Labour frontbencher Imran Khan resigning to advocate for the Gaza ceasefire. Do you think there is a reckoning from UK politicians that their constituents are not happy about their inhumane stance on what's happening in the Gaza Strip as we speak?
Of course. I mean, many of these Labour leaders that get voted in, our MPs, they're voted in by their constituents. So if a constituent is not happy with the leader that's currently in and where they stand on genocide, that should definitely be called into question. And it's actually a good thing, like Sakina just said, that many of these MPs and leaders are resigning because They want to be on the right side of history. When this Gaza war does, you know, hopefully end very, very soon, people will be noticed as to who spoke up and who did not. And I think that many people with real morals and ethics want to be on the right side of history, hence why we're seeing this.
And with those comments, we're coming to the end of the show. Let me thank my guests, Sekin Adatu and Khaled El-Jamal. And of course you, Gaza Under Attack, will be back with more. Until then, goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump has reportedly discussed sensitive information with an Australian billionaire at his Florida country club. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Donald Trump allegedly discussed sensitive information pertaining to American nuclear submarines with an Australian billionaire at his Mar-a-Lago resort, according to three people familiar with the matter. The individual, Anthony Pratt, has been identified as a potential witness in special counsel Jack Smith's case against the former president. Sources with knowledge of the situation confirmed to CBS News. The special counsel Jack Smith charged Donald Trump with 32 counts of the unlawful retention of national defense information after federal investigators found more than 300 documents with classified markings at his Palm Beach estate after he left office. The former president and two of his aides are also accused of engaging in various alleged obstruction schemes to block the investigation, and all have pleaded not guilty. There is no indication that the former president shared any sensitive records with the Australian businessman Anthony Pratt. Pratt is not accused of any wrongdoing. ABC News first reported Donald Trump's conversations with Anthony Pratt, and the New York Times first reported Pratt's potential involvement in the upcoming criminal trial. Trump has consistently denied wrongdoing in the case and, on Friday, 6th of October, called stories about his conversation with Anthony Pratt false and ridiculous. I will often state that we make the best submarines and military equipment anywhere in the world, a pretty well-known fact, Donald Trump wrote on his social media site. These fake stories are put out by corrupt prosecutors trying to interfere with the presidential election of 2024. While the exact nature of the conversations and how seriously prosecutors view the allegations is not clear, Anthony Pratt's discussions with Donald Trump could be used at trial as a way to bolster the special counsel's argument that the former president mishandled sensitive information. At least some of Trump's discussions with Pratt about the capabilities of U.S. nuclear submarines occurred whilst Donald Trump was president, at a time when Australia was still under contract to purchase French submarines, according to one person familiar with the matter. Anthony Pratt was not sure about the veracity of Trump's comments. The person said, and the billionaire later recounted the story as an anecdote about the former president's desire to tout American military products as paramount. In 2021, President Biden and leaders from Australia and the United Kingdom announced a partnership between the three nations that would give Australia access to American nuclear submarine technology. The deal resulted in the cancellation of Australia's $100 billion contract with France, much to the consternation of the French. Donald Trump is accused by the special counsel of showing other individuals, on at least two other occasions, sensitive government records after he left office, including a Defense Department memo allegedly containing classified information about plans for how the United States would attack a foreign country if it ever decided to do so. Russia Today, the RT network, has also covered the same story and tells us more. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has reportedly been accused of discussing sensitive information about the nation's nuclear submarines while chatting with an Australian businessman at his Mar-a-Lago Country Club in Florida. The conversation with billionaire Anthony Pratt occurred in April of 2021, just 3 months after Trump left office, and it allegedly included references to how many warheads U.S. submarines carry and how close they can get to a Russian vessel without being detected. Anthony Pratt, who runs a packaging company, Pratt Industries, allegedly shared the information with more than a dozen Australian officials, as well as journalists and some of his employees. ABC News conceded that it's not clear whether Donald Trump's comments about U.S. submarines were accurate, nor did the outlet's anonymous sources specifically claimed that the information was classified. However, U.S. prosecutors and FBI agents have interviewed Anthony Pratt at least twice this year about his conversations with Donald Trump, and investigators urged the businessman not to spread the information any further because it was potentially sensitive. The allegations were reported to U.S. Special Counsel Jack Smith's team of investigators. Jack Smith is prosecuting Donald Trump for allegedly mishandling classified documents and has filed a separate indictment against the former president for trying to overturn his defeat in the 2020 presidential election. The indictment on handling of classified documents didn't include any allegations related to Trump's conversations with Anthony Pratt. Pratt, a Mar-a-Lago member, told investigators that he was trying to make conversation with Donald Trump when he brought up U.S. nuclear submarines. The billionaire suggested that Australia should start buying its submarines from the United States. Donald Trump responded by making claims about the capabilities of U.S. vessels. Anthony Pratt added that Trump didn't show him any government documents. The conversation came at a time when Australia was negotiating with President Joe Biden's administration to buy U.S. nuclear-powered submarines. The deal was completed earlier this year, with Australia agreeing to purchase three of the submarines. Anthony Pratt said he told others about the conversation with Donald Trump to show how he was advocating for Australia's interests in the United States. America's national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Months after leaving the White House, former President Donald Trump allegedly discussed potentially sensitive information about U.S. nuclear submarines with a member of his Mar-a-Lago club, an Australian billionaire who then allegedly shared the information with scores of other people, including more than a dozen foreign officials, several of his own employees, and a handful of journalists, according to sources familiar with the matter. The potential disclosure was reported to Special Counsel Jack Smith's team as they investigated Donald Trump's alleged hoarding of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. The sources have confirmed to ABC News. The information could shed further light on Trump's handling of sensitive government secrets. Prosecutors and FBI agents have at least twice this year interviewed the Mar-a-Lago member Anthony Pratt, who runs U.S.-based Pratt Industries, one of the world's largest packaging companies. In those interviews, Anthony Pratt described how, looking to make conversation with Donald Trump during a meeting at Mar-a-Lago in April of 2021, he brought up the subject of American submarine fleet, which the two had discussed before. According to Anthony Pratt's account, as described by the sources, Pratt told Donald Trump he believed Australia should start buying its submarines from the United States, to which an excited Donald Trump replied, leaning towards Pratt as if to be discreet, then told Pratt two pieces of information about U.S. submarines, the supposedly exact number of nuclear warheads they routinely carry, and exactly how closely they supposedly can get to a Russian submarine without being detected. In emails and conversations after meeting with Donald Trump, Anthony Pratt described Trump's remarks to at least 45 individuals, including 6 journalists, 11 of his company's employees, 10 Australian officials, and 3 former Australian prime ministers. While Anthony Pratt told investigators he couldn't tell if what Donald Trump said about U.S. submarines was real or just bluster, investigators nevertheless asked Pratt not to repeat the numbers that Donald Trump allegedly told him, suggesting the information could be too sensitive to relay any further. It's unclear if the information was accurate, but the episode was investigated by special counsel Jack Smith's team.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Assalamu alaikum, dear souls in search of divine parenting wisdom. This is Zainab, your host on IRIB English Radio. Prepare to be enlightened on Islamic upbringing, the program where we unravel the strategies of nurturing children within the Islamic framework. Our experts' responses are inspired by the Noble Quran and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome. Now, Brother Miqdad, we have another question. Children become furious over very small things. How can parents help them not to be furious or angry?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, this is probably a very extensive discussion. How to control anger, or anger management, as we say in technical terms. We know that this is very important. Our religion has taught us that this is something of extreme importance. In fact, all evil traits go back to controlling desires and controlling anger.
Right.
The two faculties that we have within ourselves. One is the faculty of desire, which attracts, and the faculty of anger, which repels. So we need to in our life, this is actually a life struggle that we go through. And this is where Allah tests us, is to be able to control anger. The first point I'd like to mention over here is that children are different. Some children may have a lot of anger, may have a temperament issue, a temperament challenge. They'll be getting angry very quickly. They can't control their anger. They're hot-tempered, you would say.
Okay.
Some children could be completely opposite. They'll have no issues with anger. They're very calm, very passive, very easygoing. Nothing would anger them as such. They wouldn't. Some children don't even have the voice to become angry.
Right.
Those squeaky little kids, for example, that you don't expect them to become angry at all. So you have a spectrum. And obviously, some kids are challenged and are tested by Allah with anger. Some kids are not. That's the first point. Secondly, is that anger can express itself in different ways. Some express their anger by shouting and screaming and hitting.
Right.
Some kids and some adults express their anger a more internal way of angry. Within themselves, they have this frustration. They might not necessarily scream. They might not necessarily shout and hit. But within themselves, they're very, very, very angry at themselves. Very within themselves, there's a fire that's boiling. Right. That doesn't necessarily show itself in actions. And so when we talk about anger, we talk about these different types of anger. And in all of them, we need to be able to manage our anger. This is actually the key point over here, that as parents, for ourselves, we need to manage our anger. And we need to teach our children as well how to be able to control their anger in their actions, how to make sure that this anger doesn't express in a way that goes against true human moral, true human morality, true human perfection. It doesn't harm or hurt others, whether it's their feelings or whether it's their even physical injuries sometimes. And as individuals, we need to learn how to control our anger, all types of anger. And we need to bring it to a balance, which is this this ability to be brave and courageous, which is to use our strength and our anger in its right place.
Right. And listeners, as Brother McDowell said, there are two faculties. That is the faculty of desire and another that repels that's the anger. And both need management, not just one, both of them need management. And management is really important. And as we have been talking in the various sessions, that lead by example, lead yourself by example. For your children, because children learn more from observation than they can learn from lecturing. Well, we'll discuss more on this topic with Brother McDowell after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Hey, stop! I've got a favorite game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother McDowell discussing anger management tips for children.
That which allows us to control our anger is to be able to approach situations in a rational way.
Okay.
See, a person who is able to think over their actions, think over the consequences of their actions, is able to approach any situation with logic what happens is that this person is then able to manage their anger, because they understand that if I get angry, will I achieve the objective that I want to achieve? Will I be able to reach that which I want to reach? What will be the negative consequences of me screaming, of me hitting, of me becoming angry? See, it takes a lot of self-control. It takes a lot of power in ourselves and a willpower to be able to use our mind and our rational mind before we use this faculty within ourselves of getting angry. But this is something we need to build. And so one of the things that we do in children is really make them think logical. Whenever right. you come to a situation, always react in a logical way. Always teach them to think logically, to think rationally. To explain to them a situation without emotions as much as we can. As parents, starts from parents, how we deal with situation. Because children, when they grow up, they come to different situations. Obviously, they come to this situation with their parents. Right. And they see how their parents react. I can see my mom. My mom is going to react in an emotional way. Is my dad going to get angry? Or are my parents reacting in a very rational way? And if they're constantly seeing the parents reacting in a rational way, thinking about the consequence of their actions, trying to achieve the goal that they want to achieve without the need to get angry, then they themselves would then learn the skill that I don't have to react in an emotional way, in an anger way. I can control that. I rather choose a way that is more rational, more has more reasoning behind it, and is more logical, because I want to get to a purpose. This is something that builds this willpower within ourselves, builds this willpower in children, this ability to control their anger. Or as the verse says, كَاذِمُونَ الْغَيْذِ or this kathmul ghayth, this controlling one's anger. It's a very important trait that we need to have, and this is where it comes from, with that this willpower to be able to control anger and use our reasoning and our mind to be able to make the right decisions.
Right. And as you were already discussing with us in the previous sessions, that whenever you as parents are dealing with a situation, and like the situation is kind of, you know, sometimes out of control, but try to show your children that it's not a big deal. The way you said in one of these previous sessions, I remember that if you manage the situations by teaching your children that this was really not a big deal, they will develop a different kind of confidence and they will face the situation accordingly. So there's a lot more to learn from you. And there's a lot more to learn from your advices that you give to us, your tips for me and also to all the parents out there listening to Islamic Upbringing. But we'll discuss more with you after a short break. So dear listeners, stay tuned.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Brother Miqdad, and Brother Miqdad is teaching us anger management tips for our children. Yes, Brother Miqdad.
One of the things that we learn in anger management is to always prevent the opportunity to get angry. So when you're teaching and talking to your children, bring to their attention those things that make them angry. So make them realize that, look, for instance, you get angry when your younger brother or younger sister, for example, touches your stuff. When you bring that point to their attention, then you can teach them, look, how can we react other than an anger way when this situation happens? The very fact that they've understood that, okay, these are the situations that stimulates my anger, that provokes my anger, then they are more likely
reacted differently.
They're more likely to act in a different way. They're more equipped to act in a different way because they can predict it. They know that this is going to happen when this triggers it. I know what the trigger point is. And so paying attention to the trigger point is very important. And so you can teach them, like, look, this is going to happen. You know that this causes your anger. Okay, how would you then act in a better way? And so you've already made them play the movie of that action before it happens. And so when it really does happen, they already know how to react. They know how to deal with the situation. So this is very, very important. It's important for us those parents who are struggling with anger, and then this is a very, very important tip to always find out those triggers and then play the right approach to handle those situations. And we can teach this to our children as well by pointing out those things and making them aware of these things.
So rather than scaring that I should not be getting him the trigger point or paying attention to this trigger point, you're saying, on contrary, that parents should pay attention rather to this trigger point so that they can work on this and teach them a better alternative to deal with other than anger.
Yes, some of the things you can avoid, obviously, but let's say in the example that we gave that siblings are going to touch my things, it's going to happen, right? I mean,
right.
If you have
it's
a young...
Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. You teach your child that, look, if your younger sister and younger brother, they come to your room and they maybe touch the things, I'll try my best to avoid that this to happen, right? I'll try and teach them not to touch your things. But if they do, then this is how you should
react.
And lastly, to end the show, again, we come back to something we talked about previously as well. One of the things that leads to a person not being able to control their anger is a lack of self-respect. A person who has respect, who understands that they are valuable, that they have self-worth, they are able to control their actions. They're able to control their reactions. They're able to have this willpower to react in a human way, in a very polite, respectable way. It is those individuals that don't have any self-respect, that are careless about their actions, careless about their body movement, careless about hurting others. They don't really have any worth for themselves or any worth for their actions. Therefore, this is how they will react. So again, come back to one point that we mentioned time and time again, that one of the things that we really need to work towards is to really build this self-worth in our children and self-respect in our children, because it really helps them, at least in this aspect right now, in controlling their anger.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Pratham Ekdath, for being with us and sharing those beautiful tips with us again.
Thank you to you. Jazakallah.
Thank you, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab Call of Islam and you'll find an archive of our programs there. Or in case you had any queries regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find our programs on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Death toll for Israel's onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip surpasses 11,000, mainly women and children, as the regime continues targeting schools and hospitals. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi calls for united action by Islamic countries to stop ongoing Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. And hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters blocked entrances to a factory of the UK.